Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this insightful session, Saida Ruas, acclaimed author of 18 Days of Spring and Winter, and Kasim Ali, renowned for his work Good Intentions, share personal experiences and practical advice on building a sustainable writing career, overcoming common obstacles and effectively managing dynamics between authors. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this discussion will equip you with the tools to maintain your creative momentum and navigate the intricacies of the literary world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to So You're Published, Now What? With me, Kasim Ali, and Saida Ruas. We're going to introduce ourselves in a minute, but I just wanted to say, instead of having a more formal, we talk at you for 45 minutes and then you ask us questions for 15, I'm a big fan of breaking down hierarchies and making it as informal as possible. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. Either one of us will just pick on you by some way or form. And if anything sparks anything in you, just ask the question as it comes and we'll answer them and we'll just go like that. But we'll leave some time at the end if anyone is too shy to do that. Sound good? Cool. Okay, so Saida's going to introduce herself now and I'm going to stop talking.
So I'm Saida Ruas and I am a writer, British, of Moroccan heritage. My novels include 18 Days of Spring in Winter, which is set in Cairo during the Arab Spring, as well as Assembly of the Dead, which is a historical crime set in Marrakesh in 1906, based on the true story of the Moorish Jack the Ripper, as they framed him in the media at the time. And I've also contributed to anthologies and like stuff like that. So, yes.
Stuff like that.
Just stuff like that. Random stuff.
Cool. Okay. I'm Kasim Ali. My day job up until yesterday was being an editor in publishing. So I worked at Penguin for a few years and I've just finished working at Amazon. That's right. Don't tell them. Don't tell anyone I worked there because it's a terrible place to work at. But don't tell Amazon I said that because yeah, they paid
exactly.
me.
It's too late.
Hey, I was trying to be, you know, the good person inside, trying to break it down. And turns out you can't do that, actually. And my sort of non-day job source of income, fun time thing is being an author. So my debut book was published in March 2022. By Fourth Estate, it's called Good Intentions. And here's the funny thing about me. I brought everyone else's books with me, but I didn't bring my own. So just pretend that I'm holding it here. It's beautiful, isn't it? Thank you so much. We're here to talk today about not necessarily how to get published, but sort of like what happens, I would say, once you sign that big contract and what happens.
Big. Sorry, big.
big contract and sort of what happens after you've been published and what that can kind of feel like for a debut author. I think that a lot of people focus on like the how to get published. So it's like, write this cover letter and make sure you don't call them sir because most literary agents are women and all that kind of advice. But actually there's so much that happens after you get published. Not just the editing and the sort of being in the process, but like stuff like this that's happening to us too, because we've been published and my book came out 2 years ago and here I am having an event and Saida's got a wealth of experience doing all kinds of things, right? Okay. So, yes.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the first thing I thought we could talk about is like what happens once you sign that big contract. So because I work in publishing, I thought what I could do is give you all an experience of like what it feels like to be inside the sort of publishing space a little bit, and then we can talk about post-publication. So as an editor, you acquire a book and we love the book most times. Sometimes I don't love the book, but you have to buy it because it's going to sell really well and you have to sell a piece of your soul. Because publishing needs to make money and people love making money, especially at Amazon. And once I bought an author, we start editing that author, but we also start thinking about loads of other stuff like marketing and publicity and sales and all that kind of like really interesting stuff that happens, like I wanna say horizontally adjacent to the editing of everything. one thing that I realized being an author is that actually as an editor, we're never thinking about the fact that an author only ever really talks to their editor, whereas I'm talking to six different teams about this book. And editors can sometimes feel, okay, I can sometimes feel like my authors want too much from me because I forget that actually I'm the only person they're talking to. So while I may be having like 6 to 12 to 15 to limitless meetings a week talking about how we position an author, how we sell them, what kind of events we might want to do with them, how we put them into the market, all that kind of like really interesting stuff. They have no idea. And the only way that I discovered this was when I was published myself. And I found myself being the clingy, needy author who's just like, Why are you not talking to me? Do you not like me anymore? And my editor's like, you work in publishing. You know that's not true. And I was like, yeah, but like, you haven't emailed me in like 2 weeks. And she's like, yeah, because I'm doing everything. You work in publishing. What's going on? But it's actually difficult to remove yourself from that sort of frame of mind. Even as an editor, someone who works in publishing, I kind of forgot all of that because it's quite vulnerable to be in it. So while all of that stuff is happening, you're being edited. That's great. That's fantastic. Then comes the period of the deadly silence, which is what I call it, which is basically we've edited your book. We all agree that the book is fantastic. You must have gone through this too. Mm-hmm. And then no one talks to you. No one talks to you. No one says anything for a while. It depends where you get published. Some people, it can take 2 or 3 or 4 years for them to get published. At Amazon, it took like 9 months. But there's still like a deadly silence period. And again, I'm doing all the kind of things that you think an editor is doing for their author during that deadly silence. But the author doesn't hear anything about it because I've got nothing to share with you, right? I can't share with you that we spoke to Tesco about maybe putting your book into... Why do you need to know that? Because there's no yes yet. So the deadly silence happens. And again, as an author, that was when I realized that this is a really tough period for authors because, again, I was like, where's my editor? What is she doing? Why doesn't she like me anymore? I thought she liked me. She bought this book. What's going on? And then what happens after that sort of deadly silence is the publicity stuff. And so this is where I thought you could come in and talk about your experience with publicity, because my experience, I think, has been quite different. And we'll talk about that in a second. But now you go.
Yeah, so I think that experience might be different depending on the size of the publisher. So mine was an independent publisher that didn't have 20 people working there to talk to or even outside it. So it was it's a small independent publisher, and there was communication there because they're so small. And so I spoke to them. There was this kind of quiet moment where they were editing the work and doing a lot of the work, and I remember distinctly what came back was like 50 pages of edits. So after we had this kind of editorial, like this kind of developmental conversation, like the fundamentals of the structure, and I'd fixed them, we went into this more granular editing process.
Sure.
And that was like 50 pages of like this, and literally it was a case of me working down that line, like through that list of edits, and then sending them back, and then coming back with, oh, we're now down to 30 pages, and going through that process again, and then, oh, we're down to 15, until we were down to one line, and there's a cut-off date, and we are not making any more changes. We're formatting the book now. So it was that was the kind of process.
So how did that feel? How did that feel going into... Again, as an editor, I knew that this was happening. So yeah, when I was being edited, I knew. So how did that feel for you?
There was a moment where I was like, oh. Like, I was expecting someone to be like, I love your work. It's amazing. It's, like, changed my life. And what I got was like, not sure about line 24 on page 33. And that over and over and again. And, like, I didn't get this moment of, like, this is amazing, Saida. They were like, this is what it needs to be like, and I get now, I understand that as an editor, it's about being efficient and being like being of practical support as opposed to emotional support. Like you're bringing your professional insights into that work to make it stronger as opposed to the person that's going to tell you that it's great.
But although you do sometimes have to do that.
You might have to, but like, I'm sure. But like they were like, yes, you know, they wanted to publish it, and that's always like a good indication that they like your work, I suppose. But I remember feeling a bit like, oh, I've never actually gotten an email that says they like it. It's just been like 50 pages of edits.
It's because the way that I think about it is we are seeing the potential in your work. It's actually not about seeing your work and saying we want to publish this as is. Mm. It's actually about when I'm reading submissions, I'm looking for the potential. And I'm also looking for whether I'm the right editor for you. Can
Absolutely,
I,
yeah.
if the, no book is ever perfect, you know, no one's ever told J.K. Rowling that in a long time, and you can tell because those books are bad and really long. No book is perfect, and we're all looking for ways to, as editors, like, how can I fix this? Am I the right kind of editor to be able to fix this? And so when I speak to writers, we're dealing with rejection, I quite often say to them, actually, like, it's probably like 5% because they don't like you. It's 95% because they're not the right editor. It's not the right time. It's not the right time to publish a book like that. They have something similar, like blah, 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 blah. All these like super corporate reasons.
And you develop a kind of thick skin as well afterwards, because you realize that as well, that the industry, that like the industry is not there to make you feel good about your writing. It's there to create a marketable product, right? And they've got some valuable insights as well. Editors, like for me, it was, I've learned so much from the editors that I've worked with, because they really can look at kind of like distinct parts of your writing and help you improve those distinct parts, whether that's your structure or your character development, your prose, whatever it is. And that's like, if you're open to those conversations with them and not too sensitive and recognize that at that point it becomes a shared piece of work in some ways, then I think you can really strengthen your work with it. So it's been, you know, it was a bit of like, oh, okay, fine. But at the same time, a great opportunity to learn from someone else, I think, and work with someone else on your work.
Even as an editor, I learned a lot being edited because it taught me a lot about how cold I was as an editor and how not very nice I was to my authors, because I would just go in and say, oh, this isn't working. To fix this, and that's actually not how you're supposed to do it.
Supposed
to be quite nice about it, they call it the shit sandwich, right?
Well, yeah.
You say something really nice, and then you say something terrible, and then you end it with like, "But you're really good."
Yeah, like.
And I have faith that you can fix this. So let's talk a little bit about publicity, right? Because that's the big one. That's the one that I think most people sort of. I'll talk about myself. I because I work in publishing. Don't know if I mentioned that. I might have mentioned that once or twice. Because I work in publishing, I was very aware of the fact that authors don't get a lot of publicity, right? So there are like so limited resources for publicity. And every author wants to do it, because every author that I've ever worked with, even the ones that are like, I'm actually really shy. I'm so shy. I don't like people. Even they want to be at like the Hay Festival in front of like 1,000 people talking about their book, because they really, really want to talk about their book. They're very proud of their writing and they want to be an author, and that's what authors do, right? But we can't get publicity events for all of our authors. So specifically when I worked at Penguin, it was really competitive. Like we had a whole team of publicists. We had about, I want to say 10 publicists working across, just not across all of Penguin, across the tiny bit of Penguin that I worked at, there were 10 publicists. I think across the whole of Penguin UK, there must be like about 100 maybe, like even more. And if you think about it, those 10 publicists are actually competing against each other for their own authors. So they might have a nonfiction author from this side of the list versus a nonfiction author for this side of the list. And they're fighting each other to get one spot at like Edinburgh or something. And so I went into being published with an idea that I wouldn't get any events, because I was very aware of the fact that literature festivals like this one, when it pulled people in, how do you do that? You do that by getting authors that they love. Authors they love are probably authors who've been published for like 10 years and have built a really good audience and rapport with people. They don't want a new guy who no one knows. And what was really surprising to me was that I'd gone into this contract, this publishing contract, basically saying to them, it's okay if you don't get me any events. It's completely fine. Don't worry about it. It's completely cool. And they were a bit like, oh, you don't want to do anything? And I was like, no, I want to do everything. But I completely understand if nothing comes up, right? And then I was told this like really startling fact, which was that at Fourth Estate, the two most toured authors were Sarah Winman, who's this author of like 20 years. She's published like Sunday Times bestsellers. And me, I was the second one.
Wow.
And that was really weird.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So when I said it was a bizarre thing, it's actually the good bizarre, not the bad bizarre.
Well, let's get to the bad.
So I had a very good bizarre event with publicity, in that I think just because of the nature of the kind of book I'd written and the time that it was published into, and sort of like me as well, like I think a young Pakistani male author writing about what I was writing about, I think it attracted people, interested people, and they thought that I might make a good person to do events for. But now we shift over to...
Well, again, like, you know, like, it's a small independent. I think that's what's useful, maybe, is that you kind of have that kind of bigger publisher, and I come from that small independent publisher. They had one publicist, and she left 3 weeks before my book was launching.
Was she replaced by anybody?
No.
Oh, okay. Cool,
no,
cool.
Okay. Like, because, like, she, you know, no. She was never replaced. So, essentially, there was, like, it almost felt like there was, like, some... Yeah, that it, and, you know, and it's an independent, so it's also about access, right? You can't access The Guardian if you're an independent unless you've got those connections to get it in there. You can't access Waterstones. They don't have contracts with those kind of, like, distributors even, or, like, just getting your book seen in the kind of mass of books that are out there when you're a small independent is also a challenge for them. So, you know, ultimately, I think what happened for me, and I think it happens for a lot of authors, is you find yourself doing your own promotion. You just do, and you kind of have to. And I think a lot of, like, authors from smaller ones don't have a marketing team working on their book. So they just, like, start hustling. Like, you literally are hustling to get you, because you want to be read. Like, there's no point in pretending that you're writing for the love of writing. You write for the love of writing, but you also write because you want someone to read your book. And that means they have to see your book to be, and it, and, you know, so there's that dynamic. So I just found myself doing a lot of that kind of hustling myself, and then it kind of became a bit of a snowball effect, and then it just seemed to take on its own life, where you're like, oh, someone, like, you know, there'd be moments where I'd get invited to a festival, and I'd be like, but how do they know? Like, where did they get my name? Like, what? Like, you know, you just think, well, how does that even, like, because I didn't reach out to them and no one I know. So it's that kind of, yeah, yeah, of thing. So you're like, oh, so maybe it has got a little bit of a life of its own now, and it's just doing it itself. And that kind of feels quite nice. So, you know, I think it's that kind of thing. And, you know, I think the other part is what you were referring to. Like, I think there's one part of your character where you're just like a solitary person who wants to sit in a cupboard and write. And just be left alone, for the love of God, just don't talk to me. And that says that part of you, which, like, writing is, and it, you need to be quite solitary to be able to see a novel through. And then there's a other kind of professional part of being a writer, where you have to be on stage and you have to talk to people, and, you know, you have to do the marketing stuff. And they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily in sync, right? Like, they can be different, yeah, characteristics. Like, they could be like, you know, I don't want to make it a binary of extrovert, introvert, but sometimes, I had to learn those skills. Like, I am not naturally, you know, a performer. So I had to, like, it just like, you know, really overcome these fears around presenting or talking or anything like that. And, like, there was a moment for me, I ended up doing a TEDx talk in Marrakesh, and I had, like, multiple breakdowns in the 3 months building up to that. Like, in everywhere I'd be shopping and I'd just have, like, oh my God, why have I signed up to this? And I'd be doing what, you know, and then doing that really kind of helped me overcome that fear, because I was like, minutes before stage, I was like, I'm just going to wing this. I'm literally going to go up there and just talk. I don't care at this point. And I got through it, and I was like, oh, it wasn't that, it's okay, actually. And that just gave me that bit of confidence to feel more comfortable doing this kind of stuff, because I personally find it, like, before I was like, I can't do this stuff.
But you're having a good time today.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, I'm kind of over it now. I'm like, I don't care anymore. Like, don't care. I think that's also just an aging process where you just get a bit older. And how did I start hustling? So I organised a launch myself with people. So, like, there was I organized launches in Morocco because it's set in Morocco. I can't remember if I did a launch in London. I think I might have done. Yes, I did a launch with a kind of British Moroccan society in London, and then I organized a launch in Morocco. You know, then I would kind of, like, there'd be friends helping me out, and they'd be like, you know, contact a newspaper or contact this. 9 times out of 10 we didn't get a response, but then we'd get one here and get one there. And it just kind of, like, little steps like that of doing all the stuff that you think a publicist is busy doing. Like, it'd be great to have someone doing that for you. But, and sometimes cold calling, you know, you're just cold calling people. It's quite a brutal thing to do, because you're selling your creative work to people, and it's emotionally, you're invested in it, right? And so if you get rejections, you get rejections, and you're like, damn, again. But I think you just have to kind of hustle a little bit. I hustled. That's the truth. You know, like, I felt like, sometimes I felt like, I was saying to Brad Pitt in like Fight Club, where he's on those planes going for more. I wish it wasn't that exciting, but like you're literally like sometimes like I'm carrying my books in my bag and I'm like people are selling my books for me. And you're like, is that what being a writer is? It's like selling your own books out of a suitcase. But at the same time, I think that's the experience of a lot of writers. Like that's a, you know, like it's just normal for people to do that. You don't get like, it's really hard to get that experience of like super success from day one. And there's a lot behind that that isn't based solely on the quality of your writing and the reader's response. A lot of that is having a big marketing and is having distributors and all of that stuff. But, you know, for me, it's like, it's the experience I've had, and I've kind of totally embraced it. I'm like, yep, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's I think we're so used to seeing the success stories, right?
Yeah.
So one of the ones that I think about all the time is Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, which I think everyone and their mom has read at this point. You haven't read it?
No.
It's a fine book. Actually, I quite like it. I think it's good, but yeah, anyway, It's sold tremendously well, right? And it's introduced this author, Gabrielle Zevin, to like a whole new group of people, like millions of people around the world now, essentially. But she's been publishing for 15 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
And she's kind of an incredible case study, really, of how publishing, when it should work, doesn't work. And when it shouldn't work, it does work. And how nothing actually really makes sense, because she had extraordinary success at the beginning of her career when she was published around 15 years ago, I think. And she was on like the New York Times bestseller list because she's American. Wow. And then her next book completely flopped and tanked and like nobody bought it. And she has these stories of going to book events after having had this massive book that people came to that no one then came to because they didn't know about the book she was talking about. And then she publishes a different kind of book, has again relatively bigger success, but not as big as the first one. But then the book after that, completely dead. It's fascinating,
that
like
is
listening
fascinating.
To her talk about it.
Yeah.
And then she took a break from publishing and she started doing video games. And I think her husband works in video games. And so she just started helping him. And then that was how she was inspired to write Tomorrow, 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 which video games is like a big part of. And then she wrote that. It sold for like 7 figures in the US. And it sold for 6 figures in the UK. But it sold for 9 figures. Didn't know they went up that high. To Universal, the film rights did. So
yeah,
she became
crazy.
Huge. But like 15 years... Yes, Yusra, yes.
Is it true that publishing really is like the book Yellowface, where the main publishers choose like only one or two books a year that they're going to pour all their budget into for publicity, and then all the other books sort of get left on the side?
I have no idea.
So Yellowface, who doesn't know the book Yellowface?
Damn.
That's okay. That's absolutely okay. Not everyone has to read everything. Not every book is for everyone. Absolutely fine. Yellowface is a book by R.F. Kuang, who is a fantasy writer from America who has had great success. She's 26 and is doing a PhD in Oxford or something ridiculous. Like, great. Good for you, Rebecca. Not jealous or envious of her intellect at all. And she's published 4 New York Times bestsellers and she's huge. And she wrote this book called Yellowface, which is essentially about the publishing industry.
Oh.
And to put it very simplistically, it's about a... from the perspective of a white woman who pretends to be Asian to get published and has success that way. And it's a satire and it's like supposedly brilliant. I think it's terrible. I think Rebecca has had access to like one tiny bit of publishing.
Yeah, like I wouldn't say that was my experience. I think, again, in independent, you don't get the same experience because they're not corporations.
But also even at Penguin. So at Penguin, we had big books that sold for lots of money. So for example, I worked on Will Smith's memoir. Never met him, never spoke to him. Never got slapped by him, but there's still time. There's still potential, thank you. And of course, they gave a lot of resources to that book because he's a celebrity and they knew it was gonna sell a certain amount and that he would expect a certain amount because he was a celebrity. That makes sense. But once you take celebrity books out of it and you're just looking at, say, regular schmegular people, I'll take myself as an example. My book didn't sell anything, but I got the second most publicity that year from my publisher. So actually, this idea that a book's budget is determined by either the advance that the publisher has given to the author or the amount of copies that they think is going to sell is actually fundamentally untrue, because the publisher doesn't actually want any of its books to fail. And I think what happens is books do fail, and certain books fail because of certain reasons, which we can get into later if we want to. But what it makes readers think and people who haven't been published yet is, oh, that publisher let that author down. Mm-hmm. That publisher bought that book and they didn't try to sell it as well as they could have. To which I would then question, what business would pay money to then not try to get that money back? Mm-hmm. So actually publishing is filled with lots and lots of people who are actively trying to sell every single book. Mm-hmm. I was bought in a 2-book contract. My first book sold literally nothing. Yeah, like comparative. I know the data. I work in publishing. I'm over it, I promise. My second book with the publisher is coming out next year. And they're already talking about, you know, doing lots of publicity for it. They're already talking about pushing it quite a bit. And the reason they want to do that is, A, fundamentally, they do believe in me as an author, which is like wonderful and feels very nice to be supported. But also, guess what? They really want the money they paid me back, because that's how they make money. They need to get the money they paid you back, because they said they'd give you the money and now they have, and they want it back. It's just how capitalism works. And so I think a book like Yellowface has sort of made people think that publishing is this like bizarre beast that like buys books and then doesn't do anything with them and is happy to let them lose money. It's just untrue. It's like a funny thing that people talk about in regards to publishing. And so that's why I don't really like Yellowface, because I think actually what Rebecca has done is taken her one very tiny understanding of publishing. And remember, she's an author. She's not actually worked in publishing, and she's kind of run with it. And now a million people have read that book, and I worry about what they've done, what she's done to publishing.
I remember, like, when I was first published, I was like, well, I'm not really a writer until, like, it's reviewed somewhere. And so then it was reviewed. And then I was like, well, I'm not really a writer until I just walk into a Waterstones and it's there. And then I walked into Waterstones in Walthamstow and it was there. Or, like, oh, I'm not really a writer until I'm doing a book festival. And then I'm shifting the goalposts on myself all the time. And I'm hungry for, like, these markers of writer success. And they're not, I think that those points of success are not just determined by the quality of your writing, right? They're determined by like the kind of industry that you're talking about, that you lift the curtain and you see the complexity of the industry. And that's like, and I feel like that kind of can be really toxic, and it became a bit toxic for me, and it infects me and my creativity. And so I was like, actually, I'm going to just like, I had to just kind of park all that stuff and be like, actually, what I want to do is write, be read, and like connect with people. And then I started really appreciating these moments where, you know, like I'm at a university in Morocco and there's like a young, like aspiring Moroccan writer who wants to write in English. And it's like, your book was so important to me, because I just haven't found like a book that I can read about Morocco in English that isn't like, you know, European with Morocco as a backdrop and they've got an alcohol problem in Marrakesh and, you know, whatever it is, the kind of like exotic version of Morocco as a backdrop. And it, you know, that connection was, now I've come to appreciate that that connection is the most important outcome of being published for me, right? That is the most important thing, genuinely. And that's the thing that actually gives me value, like that I get value from and like appreciate, you know, like that's what fulfills me. The other stuff, you kind of, it comes and goes and it can be snatched from you. And I'm not saying I've had those successes at that scale, I haven't. But they can also be taken from you these days with one silly thing and it's all gone. And like, I think it's important not to get on that kind of, like try to avoid all of that and just remember what this is, like what it is you're doing. And like, that's what's important to me. And that's where I keep my kind of zen about writing, instead of being like, oh no, The Guardian and this and all that or whatever it is. I'm like, whatever. And at this point, I'm like, it doesn't matter.
I'm not quite there yet, because I do still think those things all the time, actually.
No, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, I'd love those things. But if someone was like, oh, we're going to give you like a 9-figure deal and you're going to write. I'd be like, you know, what do I have to do to make that happen? But I'm just saying, it's, you know, that you've got to balance it out, I think, and have some perspective.
I wonder if I could ask about that period after that first month from publication. So your publisher's been on it, helped you get stuff during the first month.
Sure.
And then you kind of, you're on your own. And it's like, what's next? So I write for kids, so I at least have school visits maybe to
kind of
go from. But what tips would you have for people who are in that situation after?
So I think you have to, So, okay. So my experience is so, so strange, so different because I work in publishing. Because I work in publishing, what that does is it makes people think that I'm some sort of like messiah figure because I am an editor and an author too, and they think that I have access to like a cornucopia of knowledge. And so I got invited to like loads of places just based off of that. But for my authors, and it was really bizarre actually, I was at Penguin and it was just before I was leaving, I got invited to an event. I can't remember where that event was, but I knew that one of my authors had been pitched for that event. I got turned down, but I got it as an author. And that was quite hard because how do I talk to my author and say, you didn't get this thing, but I got it. Anyway, really weird. So I've had a really strange space in it. But for my authors, what I always say to them is the publicist, at least the publicist that I've worked with at Penguin and at Amazon, the shortest amount of time that they're pushing you is like 9 months. So they do you 6 months before the book and 3 months after it. Like that's the shortest amount of time. Because, like I said, they're trying their best to actually get you kind of everywhere. And they, when they pitch you for festivals like this, they do it quite a while out. When they pitch you for reviews in The Guardian, they do that quite a while out. When they pitch you for like articles and features, it's like quite a while out that they do all that kind of stuff. So they're actually working all the way back there. But what I always say to them is, if it feels like nothing is happening, the first thing you do is talk to me, right? You come to me as your editor and you say, why am I not getting XYZ? Now, I can tell you why, or we can have a conversation, but we can't even have any of those things until you ask the question, right? Because sadly, editors have like, I had 20 authors at Amazon. So like, I'm not thinking about one person all the time. I have like so many books. The other thing that I always say to them is come to me with ideas, right? So if you think you need to be doing more school visits, let's just say, for example, then come to me with a list of like, what schools do you wanna go to? What kind of vibe do you want to like bring to those school visits? And let's talk about it. And then I can figure out how to talk to my publicist and see if they have connections with people. Or maybe it's worth you reaching out properly. Or maybe I should reach out to your editors. Like have a conversation about it. And let's talk about where you feel you are, where you feel you want to be. It's basically what I say to them is just talk to me about it. Don't suffer in silence and think that we should be bringing you everything. Because actually, we will bring you stuff. And hopefully, we'll bring you a lot of stuff. But I also want to know from you, like, what do you want? Because sometimes there was an author at Amazon actually who he had a lot of publicity thrown at him because he was of a certain demographic, shall we say, and he was non-white. And he had a lot of publicity thrown at him and he turned it all down. And it was really hard because actually our publicist had been working on getting him all this stuff for a long time. He just turned it down because he said that he thought that it was coming for him because he was non-white, which was true. But also, like, it's stuff that you said you wanted to do, and we're pitching you because you've written about being non-white. So, like, it was very complicated, thorny situation.
Yeah.
And so rather than we should avoid that by having a conversation, I think Zaida can talk more about the hustling bit. But from the publishing side, that's what I always say to every one of my authors. It's like, no question is not worth asking, right? You're not made to feel smaller because you've asked a question. You're not stupid for asking a question. You're not being ignored because I haven't preempted the question. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just have the conversation and trust your publishers. The other thing that I always say is get your agent to do it, because if you have an agent, and I know some people don't, but if you have an agent, they can ask the really hard questions and be the bad guy for you. Hustling, do you want to?
You know, I think it's the same. Like, I did go to my publisher and worked with my publisher on events and activities and went with them because I realised that the publicist was gone. And so, like, it fell on, like, I don't think there was a specific person that was working on my books exclusively on getting it out there. They did some stuff and they tried and had some successes here and there, but nothing major. So I just kind of started working with them saying, I wanted to do this, I wanted to do that. And they're like, go for it. I was lifting all the load and doing all the work and it was, you know, good. But I think it's the same kind of thing. Like, I did work with my publisher and then just worked with the networks. I think you find you're kind of a tribe of people that are like, can kind of start backing you. And they're like, oh, I told my friend who's got a bookshop here and da da da. And you just find your way through, right? And you just
find,
but yeah, there are silent moments. There are moments where nothing's happening and you feel forgotten. But again, I think it's that kind of like, it's almost like that, you know, trending for 7 minutes thing, isn't it? Like that dopamine rush and then it's gone. And do you kind of spend your time seeking that again? Or do you just kind of recognize that you're running a business at this point? Like, it's almost like you're running a business and this is a product. And so you have to, and that's done gradually and kind of.
And that sort of happens for everyone. I mean, I'm going to talk about film for a second because I love film. But Chloe Zhao won Best Director, Best Picture at the Oscars for Nomadland, which is a film that nobody watched, but I watched it.
I've watched it.
Did you like it?
The one with the caravans?
Yeah.
I thought it was the book called The Film.
The film?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay.
It's very different to the book.
I don't like it. But see, different opinions, which is great. Mm. Fantastic. But she is like the third woman to ever win Best Director. And where is she now? She's literally nowhere. Like, she's like, you don't hear about her because she's just busy working on the next film, right? Mm. And so there's like a period of huge silence for her now where she's just doing the work right?
Yeah.
And then the film will come out, and of course, she will get access to publicity that we could not even dream of. But she, even someone like her, who's like the third woman to win Best Director, I think the only non-white woman to have won Best Director, if I've got that right, she's completely silent and she's doing the work. So it's like, it's really hard not to feel like you're being ignored, and that, oh, like one of my favorite phrases, which my French killer over there will laugh at, is I like to tell her that I've died a cultural death since my book came out, because then she's laughing, because nothing is happening for the book, right? And then she reminds me, nothing's happening for the book because it's been 2 years and this is how publishing works, and your next book is coming out, and then you will rise again like the phoenix from the ashes. It's really hard to remember that actually you're supposed to have the highs and not the lows, but like the breaks, you know?
You have to adjust your expectations a little bit, don't you?
So I'll actually be completely upfront with all of you, because my publisher probably doesn't want me to be, but I think being open and honest is like really important. So I sold my debut book in a 2-book contract to Fourth Estate for £125,000.
Damn.
It's about £124,000 more than I thought it would. And it sold in the US for $40,000, which is about $40,000 more than I thought it would sell in the US. And I only sold there. And that's it. That's all I sold. And I was consumed by the idea that I needed to be sold in Germany, because Germany is really big. And if you get sold in Germany, then you get sold in other smaller European countries. And if that happens, it spills over to Asia. And that never happened for me. And I was really upset. Now, I know from working in publishing, from looking at the profit and loss documents that we all have access to, if you buy a book in a 2-book contract for that much money, you're looking at selling around 50,000 hardbacks. Anyone want to guess how many hardbacks I sold? I sold 1,200.
God, it's crazy.
So I didn't sell anything, right? Comparative. Mm-hmm. And then there was a really big conversation we had with the publisher, with my editor. I put a lot of that guilt on myself. I put a lot of the responsibility on my own shoulders. And I said, I could have done more. I should have done more. I should have written a better book. I should have been a better writer. I'm terrible. We don't need to turn this into a therapy session. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was that we would focus on the paperback. And then when the paperback came out, the first week it sold 89 copies, which is essentially your book is dead. Because if your book has been pushed by a major publisher like Fourth Estate and it sells under 100 copies in its first week, your book is dead. And I've sold 1,000 paperbacks the last time I checked. But I checked like 4 months ago, so who knows? It might be 1,005. So those are the
crazy
numbers that I'm dealing
but
with.
But it's so unpredictable as well. Like, you just don't know what's going to happen. I've got a friend that sold 6 figures and then sold 6 figures in the US, and it tanked on the sales, like it just tanked. And it's like, there's really no way of knowing how it's gonna play out.
We have like 7 minutes.
Oh, I was gonna say, there is a lady here that had.
So I was gonna say your figures were like my breakthrough figures. I was here feeling very sheepish, thinking, okay, those were my really good figures. So I'm from the UAE. With a publishing house. I'm also a children's author, but my question is, how many? So my publishers keep saying, you need to keep writing, otherwise you're going to become irrelevant.
Cultural
so
death.
My thing is, I launched my first book, and like you said, I feel like when you're writing for children, you depend a lot on your school visits.
Yeah.
And I thought they were doing really, really well in school visits. But then, and you know, writing, it takes time. It's like creative. So did my first book. Within the second year, right, what's your second idea? What's your third idea? And it gets a bit overwhelming. So I've got this fear of, if I don't produce every year or every few months, that's it, I'm going to be irrelevant. So what would your take be on that?
My take on that would be that the second woman to win Best Director for The Power of the Dog, she took 14 years between her last film and that film. So like, absolutely, you have no idea what might happen. You could take 5 years off, right? And you could write a brilliant kids book that becomes like an incredible bestseller. Or you could take 5 years off and write an incredible kids book that sells nothing. Like, it's so hard to tell. And the thing that publishing does do is it puts you on, we were talking about the hamster wheel, it puts you on the hamster wheel, the conveyor belt, actually. And it tells you, you need to publish every 9 months. You need to publish every 9 months, and it needs to be 40,000 words long, and you need to have this many characters and this many talking animals, and you need to do this many school visits. But, like, you could do all of that and nothing could happen. You could do all of that and everything could happen. Like, you actually have no idea. And so, again, when I work in commercial fiction, and, like, a lot of commercial fiction writers publish once a year, right? Mm-hmm. So they have, like, a hardback in, say, April, and then they have the paperback in September, and they do that, like, every year.
God, I couldn't.
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy. Some writers love doing that. Some writers find it really hard.
Yeah, some are prolific and some are not, right?
Exactly. And so what I say to my authors is, rather than putting out, and forgive my language here, a really shit book, because you feel like you have to, right? Take the time to step back. So again, talking about myself, my second book was supposed to come out in April. And because I was having an existential crisis about... many things. it's now coming out in July next year, and I rewrote it 4 times. And I took the time to really do that, and I spoke with my agent and my publisher, and I was really open and honest with them about the fact that actually, I can't do this. I've rewritten this thing 4 times. I have no idea if I'm a good writer anymore. I feel like I'm losing my mind. I feel like my brain is coming out of my ears, and I'm like crying all the time, and not at like commercials or puppies, but like just crying on myself, which is really sad and, you know, embarrassing for a man of my age. Could we just give me some time? And they did. Because you never know what's going to happen. So I would say to you that if you're feeling like creatively stuck and dead, take the time. Nothing bad ever happened for taking the time.
I almost feel guilty for taking the time. It's like, as you said, are you a real writer if you're taking the time off?
Oh my God, what's a real writer?
Yeah, like I feel like also if there are people putting pressure on you to produce, you need to renegotiate that, like reshape that relationship with those people, because they may be putting that pressure on for like money. And actually, creativity doesn't operate by a kind of money system, right? Like, yeah, it stunts it. So maybe you need to like have the conversation that you're talking about that you had, because they have to respect that kind of creative boundary and don't really have the right to.
You should
to that pressure, that level of pressure.
Remember that they bought you because they see potential in you. Remember that. I'm not buying books as an editor. I mean, I don't do it anymore. Last day of Friday. But I'm not buying books because I have to buy books, right? Because if I was doing that, agents get like 500 to 1,000 submissions a month, and editors get about 50 to 100 submissions a month, right? So we get so many submissions. I could theoretically publish all of them. 99% of them are kind of terrible. Could publish all of those people because, you know, theoretically they're like finished books that read decently, but some of them aren't working for me, some of them aren't good, whatever it might be. So take the time. Just take the time. We're not publishing you because we have to publish you. We don't owe you anything, you don't owe us anything. Take the time. I promise you nothing bad will happen. We have one question, yes?
Yeah, hi. So my question is this thing about an author having lots of copies of their book to kind of put out there. If I were to do that, I would have to buy lots of copies of my own book. Obviously, we all have ambitions that writing will make us money somehow. And when it takes money, I really struggle with that. Do I just need to get over it, or are there other ways around?
It's really difficult with independent publishers, because I know that they don't have access to like the reams of resources that big corporate publishers have. And so they do ask their authors to buy copies at like, I think, a discount of like 50% or 75% or whatever it might be.
Yeah, no, I mean, my publisher never said I had to buy copies, but they offered me a discount what I bought. And then I sold at the market rate, recognizing that I am going to have to sell my own book at events. So you need a stock of books when you're doing events to sell them. And so you need to buy those books at that discount in order to be able to stock them.
And it's the same thing with bigger publishers.
There's costs involved, right, in printing it.
So it's the same thing with bigger publishers. Like if I go to an event that doesn't have a bookshop and I want to sell books there, like I can absolutely go to my publisher and ask them, can I buy X amount of books at the sort of rate that you sell them to, say, Waterstones or whatever? And they will give you a lesser discount, but a discount nonetheless, and then you buy those books. Most of the time, my publisher has a relationship with the bookshop at the event, or the bookshop at the event has actually spoken to me and said, we'll get your book in. It's really hard for me to answer it, because ultimately, when you're talking about you need to pay something. You shouldn't pay an agent to read your work. Mm. You shouldn't pay publishers to be published. I mean, traditional publishers, if anyone comes to you and asks you to pay, they're not a traditional publisher. They just want to make money off you. You shouldn't do those things. But there are other things that you do kind of have to pay for. Like sometimes I have to pay for travel to get somewhere because I've deemed that worthy of the cost to go do some things. I really want to do it. Or sometimes I do have to buy my own books and bring them with me. There are costs that you, but every cost should be considered. So it's not an easy answer, but it's like you do sometimes have to pay. And I know that's really difficult, but you do sometimes have to. But it should be something you have to pay for, not something that you're profiting to, you know, someone else is profiting off you. Mm. Does that make sense? Sorry, I know it's not the best answer. Sorry, I wish we could stay here for another hour, but we have to go because other people need this room.
Thank you. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 27th of June with a huge programme of events, from comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your ticket now.